present folder, not the new one, present folder, to page 52. Okay, this is the trial, Roman phase. We've already had the Jewish phase, if you want to even call it a trial. That's why I put the word trial in quotation marks, because it wasn't really a trial, it was a mockery. Jesus has faced the Jews, and now he's being brought before Pilate. And why did they have to bring him before Pilate anyway? He was a Galilean, but what were the Jews limited in? Yeah, they could not put anybody to death. They didn't have that kind of authority. So they could have, and they did, they accused him and indicted him all they want to, but a Jewish indictment of itself was not going to be sufficient. They're going to have the Romans side with them on this, so they've got to go before Rome, if you will. So, and I got the A there because he was before Pilate two times. So this is the first meeting before Pilate. And the first two verses, you'll see that Jesus is standing there before Pilate. This is verse 1. And verse 2, the Jews are standing there making their accusations or their formal charges. What did they accuse him of? There's three things listed in verse 2. Right? Perverting or misleading the nation, some versions say. All right? He's forbidding us from paying taxes. One more thing. He's came to be a king. Now, they're hoping that last one would really catch the attention, because what's the problem with that accusation? Well, what were they hoping to gain by that accusation? Yeah, he's a traitor. This is treason. He is trying to usurp the Caesar's throne. Any one of these charges stand out at you just as blatantly false? Well, of course, we know they all were, but, I mean, really false? Yeah, because we notice in chapter 20, what was Jesus asked? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And though he didn't give a single one-word answer, yes or no, go back and you read Luke 20, 22-26, what did he say? That's what you need to do. You render to Caesar what belongs to him. They were discussing the money. They were discussing taxes. So that was just an out-and-out lie, what they were charging Jesus here before Pilate. After this charge is made, Pilate asked Jesus regarding his kingship, if you will. He says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" What did Jesus say? Yeah. He didn't deny it, did he? He said, "It is as you say." Yes, if you will. So, Pilate, as they began having this conversation, what decision did Pilate come to in his own mind initially?
Well, he wasn't any kind of threat then.
I don't see a problem here. He did not want to render a judgment. I believe it's Mark's gospel that says somewhere, not a part of that book, that Pilate knew that the Jews had delivered Jesus up for envy. Pilate could see the writing on the wall here. He knew what this was about. As Norm says, he's not a threat. He's not inciting public riots. He's not a threat to the Roman crown. This is entirely a religious matter that's just got these Jews all worked up. But it does not affect Roman public policy, if you will. So in his mind, he doesn't see the need to render a judgment. This is in verse 4. I find no guilt or no fault. We need to give the Jews an A for what, though? Look at the next verse. They get an A for effort. It says they were persistent. They were not going to let this go. All right? They have come this far. Think of the months and the years of planning and scheming they've been doing. And they finally have Jesus where they want him, before the Romans, and they're not going to quit. So they are very persistent. Again, they accuse Jesus of inciting crowds, and then they say all over Judea, and as far away as up north in Galilee. Now, there's something important about that last statement. What about that, Charles, when they say Galilee? Oh, Pilate's ears perked up, I'm sure, when he heard Galilee. Pilate, as we'll see later, and I've got it on the charts here, Pilate was a political coward. That's really what he was. And anything that he could have done to get out of this mess, he's willing to do. And when he heard Galilee, what do you think the first name that popped in his head was? Herod. I'm going to let Herod fool with this. I'll be done with this. And if there's any fallout politically, it won't be my head, it'll be his. I don't have to worry about that. So, technically, Herod was in charge of Galilee. And maybe there was a precedent for that. But still, Pilate was looking for a way out of this. And when he heard that, he was glad to hear it. Yes, yes. Well, he could. Yes, Wayne's taking us back to, is it chapter 13? I've forgotten about that, Wayne. Pilate had mingled the blood of some Galileans with their sacrifices. So, there's some bad blood, but there's some problems between Pilate and the Galileans. So anything he can do to get rid of this, he's fine to do it. So he turns him over to Herod. This is Pilate's political out. And he's a politician through and through. And he'll do that. So that pretty much ends Jesus' first audience before Pilate. Now he comes before Herod. And Jesus was not sent away to Herod. Herod was in Jerusalem. So it wouldn't be like sending Jesus up to Galilee and then back to Pilate. No, he's there in the city. All right. When Herod gets in before him, what's Herod's first response? As Luke writes it. He was glad to see him. Now, is it because he wanted to learn from Jesus? No. Albert, what's he wanting? I want you to amuse me. Show me a sign. I've been hearing about all these things. Remember in the latter part of Jesus' ministry, he was avoiding Herod's district or jurisdiction. Not because he was afraid of him, but because it would have been thwarting the plan that Jesus was working on to lead up to this moment. So Herod had been searching for him and wanting to see him. And so now he says, do some tricks for me. Let me see some magic. Let me see some signs. What was Jesus' answer? He just stood there. He had no response. Now, the Jews were there also. And before Herod, as you see, this is in verse 10, they continue their accusations. They don't stop that. And Jesus just stands there. Any prophetic importance to this? What about the suffering servant in Isaiah 53? As a lamb led before its shearers, he opened not his mouth. Silent. Didn't say a word. Fulfilling that prophecy. Well, sir. Yes, same Herod. Very, very ruthless characters. No love lost between Herod and those who are trying to carry out the will of God. Well, when it comes clear to Herod that Jesus is not going to play ball with him, he's not going to say anything, he's not going to show him a miracle, how do Herod and his men treat Jesus? Mocked him with contempt. They put a robe of royalty upon him. Now, they didn't mean that sincerely, obviously. And then what do? Send him back to Pilate. Herod wasn't going to get what he wanted, so he sends him back. And what is the political fallout from this brief encounter with Herod, as Luke records it? Now, before, how were relations between Pilate and Herod? They didn't send one another cards, I don't think. They didn't like one another. But for some reason, when Herod is sent Jesus and he sends him back, that sort of warmed up the friendship, if you will. So they weren't political enemies, now they're friends again. And so Pilate, I'm sure when he received Jesus back, thought, great. I thought I was through with this guy, but I've got him back. And so now he knows he's pretty much stuck with Jesus. So this takes us to the second part of Jesus' standing before Pilate. This is top of page 53. All right, so what does Pilate do now? Question 6, verses 13 through 16. So he says, I find no fault, I find no guilt, so I'm going to do what? I'm going to punish him. I'm going to try to appease you people. Okay, I'll inflict some pain on him. And then I'm going to do what? I'm going to let him go. Now, Luke tells us why this was Pilate's decision. Verse 17. All right, this time of course is Passover. And so it was an annual act of clemency of some sort. Let's release a prisoner. And so Pilate can think of no one else better than Jesus to get him out of this dilemma. But he's willing also to inflict some pain on the Lord. So I'll have him whipped or scourged or whatever. We'll do something. And then I'll release him, and that'll hopefully satisfy or pacify the Jews. And that'll let me keep my little tradition here of releasing a prisoner. Well, Pilate wasn't counting on something, I'm convinced. What was that, Buford? And that's a good way to put that. Barabbas was a real bona fide criminal. Jesus has done nothing wrong. And the Jews are aware of his annual charitable deed of releasing a prisoner. So instead, they demand the release of Barabbas. Now, what was his crime? Two things that are mentioned. He's a murderer, and he's an insurrectionist. What's insurrection, by the way? Troublemaker. Well, a big troublemaker. That's a treason. Nor mentioned treason or traitor a while ago, thinking that that was the charge against Jesus. Barabbas was actually guilty of that, trying to stir up trouble against the government. So, and he killed along the way. That would serve his purpose. He was a real tough guy. And the Jews actually asked for him. And that stupefied Pilate. Why? What evil has he done? No, I will punish him and I will release him. And that wasn't going to satisfy the Jews. Pilate could not overcome the Jewish persistence. Verses 20 through 23, especially verse 21. Well, 20 says Pilate wants to release him. But look at verse 22, verse 21. They kept crying what? Now, let's try in our minds to create a mob scene. That's what this was. This was a mob scene. Pilate's the governor. He's the one in charge. But this is getting out of hand. And, of course, that's going to look bad where? That'll look bad in Rome. And so he's really caught between a rock and a hard place, the old saying goes. And they would cry all the more. No, crucify him. And I'm sure it was getting louder and more thunderous, something that Pilate was getting more and more troubled at. But he still knew he did nothing wrong. Verse 22, why, what evil has he done? I find no guilt in this man that demands death. I will therefore punish him and release him. He's made up his mind. Now, you would think somebody's made up their mind, well, that's the end of it. But that's why I say Pilate was a political coward, because he was letting the crowd intimidate him. And so, as we learn from Matthew's gospel, it's not recorded here in Luke, what did Pilate do as a symbol or as a gesture? He took a basin of water. You ever wonder where the phrase, I washed my hands of this whole thing, comes from? I'm sure it comes from this. He washed his hands of the matter and he says, you see to it. I'm through with it. And he gave in. and delivered Jesus to be crucified. Now, of course, Jesus was scourged before he was crucified, and we don't want to forget that. I don't even think Luke mentions that. That's in the other gospel records. But Pilate gives in to this pressure. His problem is he's a political coward, as I said. He allowed the crowd to intimidate him, and he became afraid. 2 points from John's Gospel, chapter 19. Look there with me real quickly. John chapter 19, verses 12 and 15. Some statements that were made on the occasion as John records them. The Jews, of course, know that Pilate's intention is to release them, to release Jesus. And so they say to him, John 19, verse 12, if you release this man, what's the pressure they put on him? You're no friend of Caesar. And they even go one step further saying, whoever makes himself out to be king opposes Caesar. Now, you don't want to go down that road, do you, Pilate? And so drop down to verse 15. They say, crucify him. And Pilate said, shall I crucify your king? What'd they say? We have no king but Caesar. Now, how do the Jews really feel about Caesar and the Roman Empire? They hate him. There's no great affection and no heartfelt loyalty. But when it comes to this, they'll go this route all the way. Yes, Charles. 1 Samuel 8. Yes. The King of Kings. Yes. Rejecting the very King that God sent to them. King of Kings, the Messiah. So, Pilate will bow to this pressure. He's a politician through and through, trying to keep peace here in Jerusalem. Now, the question I've asked is in John 19, verse 14, question 8. What time on Friday was this that Jesus stood before Pilate? And as John records it, it's the sixth hour of the day. Now, we can get into some trouble unless we can, in our minds, reason it out. There's different references to times or different hours of the day used by the different gospel writers, and they don't always use the same way of configuring time. That doesn't need to be very alarming. We just need to be aware of that. I think what's being referenced here, because of the other references to when Jesus was on the cross, this has to be the sixth hour being 6 a.m., using a form. And there's more than one form of Roman time also. So we're going to take the position that this was about 6 o'clock in the morning that Jesus was before Pilate, because we know he was on the cross by 9. He had been up all night before with that Jewish mockery of a trial. And so just imagine how tired the Lord was. Now, he had just been run through the ringer, so to speak. And beaten, yes. Okay. So that's about where we are on Friday. And any particular importance to this Friday? That particular Friday? Well, what was it called? The preparation day. For what reason? Because it's Passover. It's the day before the Sabbath. That's right. Okay. So now we have the actual crucifixion. Think of the journey we've taken this quarter. All the things we've talked about as Luke, just focusing on Luke's gospel as it's been recorded, been bringing us up to this moment, the death of the Lord, the crucifixion. All right. Question 9. What is recorded in verse 26 of Luke 23? All right, there's a man named Simon of Cyrene. And he was compelled to bear the cross. And why is that? All right. And Luke doesn't record the scourging, but we see from other places. he had been scourged. And real quickly, what's involved in scourging? All right, it's a whip made of leather straps, not in more than one, and into each leather strap, some have said that were interwoven pieces of bone or metal, could be, that when it was lashed upon the victim, it literally tore out chunks of flesh. And that's what the Lord went through. And some writers will say many victims didn't even make it to the cross. They died from that. That was it. But we know Jesus did. So now He's endured that, and He must now carry His cross. And victims always had to carry their own cross. That was the drill. Jesus can't carry His. He's just physically too weak. And so they compel a man. And I think as it says there, Simon, I turned to the right page here. In verse 26, he carried it behind. So Jesus walked ahead of Simon, and Simon was bearing the cross behind the Lord on the way to Golgotha, or the place of the skull. So they come now to the place of the skull, and, well, they're not there yet, en route. As Luke records, verse 27, what does Jesus notice? Excuse me. They're crying, weeping. This was a very emotional moment, obviously, and that's an understatement. But what's Jesus saying? Don't cry for me. Now, He's not trying to be tough. This is the plan. This I know I've got to do this, so do not weep for me. Rather, He says, weep for yourselves and your children, because what's going to happen? AD 70. We've referenced this already a couple times in the class. Jesus has referred to this at least two other times in Luke's gospel. You need to weep for yourselves and what's coming, because what are they doing with this crucifixion as it relates to AD 70? Absolutely. That's the judgment God will give them because of their rejection of the king. And God will destroy that city and use the Romans to do it. So some 40 years later, things will be happening over the next 40 years that eventually lead up to the final decimation of the city, a judgment from God. All right? And then also we see in verse 32, two others were going with Jesus to be crucified. Chapter 22 and verse 37, what did Jesus say when He was talking to the disciples about going out prepared this time as opposed to the limited commission when they were to take no sandal, no bag, no money? He said, this time you need to be prepared because why? Verse 37. That this which is written must be fulfilled in me. And then who does He quote? Isaiah 53. Doesn't He? He was numbered with transgressors. So this is another fulfillment of prophecy. Being crucified with actual transgressors. It's interesting. Some versions, I think, label Barabbas as a robber. Is that correct? We've already covered him briefly. It's the same word for thieves. These two. So you think these guys were just guilty of petty theft? No, they were bad boys too. They were cutthroats. Because who was crucified anyway? Worst, absolutely. They didn't crucify little common petty thieves. No, these were men, as the Romans saw it, that were deserving of such a cruel punishment because they had inflicted such great actions upon society. So, again, Jesus fulfilling prophecy by being crucified with these thieves. Now, at Golgotha, they come to the place of the skull. You'll see there. Yes, sir. Of 31 of Luke 23. Excuse me. Jesus saying to these women, for if they do these things in the green tree, what will happen in the dry? Who's the green tree? It'd be Jesus. Green tree has life in it. They're taking the very life of the Son of God. If they're that bloodthirsty and that determined, And what about when it's dry? Now, what's going to be dry? It'd be Jerusalem. She's all dried up. There's no life in her because she's rejected everything that God had in mind for her. And so if it's this bad right now, what will it be in 40 years from now? It's going to be terrible. And God will unleash His wrath upon this place. That's how I take that verse to mean. All right? So Jesus is crucified at the place of the skull. Using Mark 15:25, it says it was the what hour of the day? Well, see, right there we've got a difference. See, if Jesus is before Pilate at 6, the sixth hour, how can He be crucified 3 hours earlier? Different way of computing time. Some will say this is the Jewish time. I'm not sure that's correct because Jewish time went from 6 p.m. to 6 p.m. the next day. 9 a.m. wouldn't be the third hour. That'd be the 15th hour. This may be another way of computing Roman time. But we don't want to get bogged down in all that. Jesus was crucified, it seems to be around 9 o'clock a.m. on Friday morning. And on the cross for how long? About 6 hours. To the ninth hour. As we see, at the ninth hour, He cried out with a loud voice. Lama, lama, sabachthani. My God, why hast Thou forsaken me? Okay, so while He's on the cross, we're going to notice several things that happen. All the time that Jesus is impaled upon that wooden tree. First thing that we notice from Luke's Gospel is that they're casting lots for His garments. Luke doesn't tell us who it is that does it. But again, if we borrow from John's Gospel, we know who it is that does it. Who casts lots for His garments? It'd be the soldiers. Any prophetic significance to that? Psalm 22. For my garments did they, or for my clothes or my garments did they cast lots. So that fulfills Scripture. Okay? Also on the cross, the crowd watches. They're just there spectating. And the Jewish rulers come by, and in great derision, they say what? And you can just see them laughing and smirking as it's being said. He saved others. He can't even save Himself. You are so pitiful. They didn't say it nice, I'm sure. Come down from the cross. Save yourselves. And we'll believe you. So He has to endure that. As if the physical pain wasn't enough. That's adding insult to injury, as the old saying goes. Pilate put the inscription upon his cross. This is the King of the Jews. We learned from John 19 who had a problem with that. The Jews didn't like that. What was their suggestion to Pilate? He said, I am the King of the Jews. Don't put that He is, just put that He claimed to be. And Pilate sort of got the last laugh. What did he say? That's why I'm not changing it. What I've written, I've written. Now you just can get over it. Am I going to alter that? So his cross is labeled, if you will, with an inscription. And then we also see on the cross, what did Jesus do? Now, to me, this is so characteristic of Jesus. Very magnanimous. He saves one of the thieves, doesn't He? In Matthew 27, in verse 44, talking about those who were casting derision at Jesus or casting insults at Him, Matthew records that both thieves were insulting Him. Both thieves were doing what everybody else did. So obviously, when we come to Luke 23, and the thief says what he says here, what's happened? He's had a change of heart. What do you call that? That's repentance. He's had a change of heart. Now, whatever it was, we don't know why he changed his mind. He admitted when he's chastising his fellow thief on the other side of Jesus over there, he says, we're getting what we deserve. We cannot sit here and claim innocence like this man can. Do not even fear God. So obviously he fears God now. Had he heard Jesus preach? We don't know. If he hadn't heard Him actually preach, maybe he heard about His preaching. Maybe he heard something about Jesus. We don't know any of that. He knew, he was convinced Jesus could save him. He knows that now. That's right. And what we want to emphasize is that when it comes down to it, and maybe we've gotten ourselves in a pretty bad spot. And I don't mean just we've made some bad judgment decisions. No, I mean we've committed sin. We've gotten down in the mud and just wallowed in it. What's the only thing we can do? Do what this thief did. Reach out and beg for mercy. That's all we can do. We can't save ourselves. Unable to do that. And so he did all he could do. Reached out to Jesus and said, Lord Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He knew he had a kingdom. I don't know what all he understood, but he knew enough to say these things that are terribly important. Remember me when you come in your kingdom. What did Jesus say? Now, a lot of people, how could Jesus have responded? Let's say you're having a bad day like Jesus. That'd be a bad day, wouldn't it? To undergo what he went through. And so you're under this much anguish and suffering, and someone asks something of you, how do people typically respond? Yeah, leave me alone. Can't you see I don't want to fool with anybody else. I've got too much to fool with right now. See, that was never Jesus' heart. Jesus always, it didn't matter what was going on in his life, Jesus was always ready and prepared and did exactly the Father's will. From our studies in Luke 19, Jesus told Zacchaeus, I have come to seek and to save that which is lost. Here's a lost thief. And Jesus is in immense physical pain at this moment, and he still does the Father's will. I tell you, that ought to move every one of us. That's the story of the Bible right there. This episode with the thief. So he saves one of the thieves. Yes, Vic. Yes. Yes. That's a good observation. The thief is saying things that the disciples should have said, recognized about the kingdom. Here's these Jewish people who are so religious, and they're acting the way they are, and the only one who mentions Jesus and his kingdom and a promise of life after death is who? It's a thug. A bloodthirsty thug. I'll tell you something. This man knew something. He knew enough to say these things. Now, real quickly, the anonymous thief on the cross, we have no idea what his name is, but he's been very popular down through the ages, hasn't he? He's been the poster child, and that's my phrase, for those who want salvation without baptism. Well, that thief wasn't baptized, and the Lord saved him. Well, therefore, I don't have to be baptized. Well, what's wrong with that reasoning? Christ hadn't died yet. That's true. What else is wrong with that reason? All right, church, the kingdom is not here yet. That's true. God can do whatever He wants. And in the gospel records, yes, I believe without any doubt that Jesus saved this thief that day. I have no problem believing that without the thief being baptized. That does not bother me. Because other references, what had Jesus done before? What about the man who was sick of the palsy and was lowered down through the hole in the roof? Thy sins are forgiven thee. And he told the Jews that day, so that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. What did he then say to the man sick of the palsy? Take up your bed and walk. I have no problem with that. Jesus can save anybody any way he wanted to, any time. That was his prerogative. But Yes. Well, I don't think it was nice. I doubt it. I think they're saying it mockingly. Yes. Yes. Right. But we need to impress upon our friends who bring this thief up. Say, look, yes, Jesus saved the thief without baptism. Jesus saved these other people without baptism. But the only thing Jesus ever said about salvation after His death and His burial and His resurrection was what? He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's what the Lord said about it. I didn't say that. That's what Jesus said about it. And so, the will has not yet been ratified. The blood has not been shed, and that Jesus has died to seal that covenant. So yes, He saved the thief. But don't make Him your example to want salvation apart from baptism, because you won't get it. That's a mistake to make that kind of reasoning. All right? Also, Luke records some unusual phenomena taking place. What happens when Jesus breathes His last? Darkness over the land from the sixth hour, which is noon. That's important. High noon. Someone says, well, it was an eclipse. I've heard that reason. The big solar eclipse for 3 hours in the middle of the day until the ninth hour. Darkness over the land. What else happened? The veil of the temple was torn in two. Other gospel writers say that the others came out of the graves. Some were raised at the death of Jesus and walked into the city. I would like to have seen that. That would have gotten my attention. Someone who died years ago now has been raised. So the veil torn in two, that is significant. We don't have time to go through this, but read Hebrews 9, those passages there, and 10. The importance of the veil being torn in two was to symbolize what? I take this to be the veil before the Ark of the Covenant. There was more than one veil in the temple, but I think it's that veil. And the writer makes this point. Access to God under the covenant, first covenant, was restricted, wasn't it? Now what is it? The death of the Lord has come. It's wide open. To who? Everybody. Everybody. Access to God is now open to all through this one that just died. And then He at last committed His spirit. He says, Father, into Thy hands I commit My spirit. And He breathed His last. Again, He's quoting, in His very death, He's quoting more Scripture. Psalm 31 and verse 5 is the quotation there. So all these things take place on the cross. Yes, sir. Yes, yes. That's a good observation to make. As His body was torn for the blood to flow, the veil. I mean, there's lots of symbolism here going on. I think that's a good observation to make. Okay, now quickly. The centurion on watch made what admission? This man is truly innocent. Some versions say this man was the Son of God. But he makes that acknowledgement on the cross. The crowds left the cross, beating their breasts. That was a sign of great mourning and anguish. Very, very sad about that. And his acquaintances, the women, they stood by watching and looking at these events. We're going to have to stop here. I didn't get to cover the last two or three verses, but again, this is material that you're very familiar with, especially the fact that Joseph asked for the body. Who was Joseph of Arimathea, by the way? As we're told, he was a council member. And was he in favor of the death? Because he had not given consent. So therefore, he asked for the body. All right, we'll pick up then with chapter 24 on Wednesday night, Lord willing. Thank you.